He travels the world and scans the web to keep you up to date on the latest threats to the internet and to your cybersecurity. He brings you the latest on the fight against cyber terrorism, keeping you safe with the best cybersecurity information on the radio. It's Cybersecurity Today with John Bambanek.
Good morning and welcome to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek, broadcasting from AM 820 News, covering Tampa Bay and the West Coast, as well as AM 1060 News, covering the Space Coast and Orlando, talking about all the cybersecurity news you need to know to protect you, yourself, and your digital identity. Connect with us online at our website, cybersecuritytodayradio.com, on Facebook and Twitter at CyberSec Radio, or email johnbambanekradio@gmail.com, johnbambenek, radio@gmail.com. Have a lot of great content coming at you today. Going to talk a little bit about the Uber breach with our digital partner, Greg Ott at cyberscoop.com. Also going to have on Jerry Thompson, Senior Vice President of Identity Guard. I know a lot of people have talked to me about identity protection services, so wanted to bring on somebody to talk about cybersecurity, protecting your digital identity, and some of the things that you can do to protect yourself. Stay tuned for those interviews. But did want to cover a couple of quick topics here right at the top of the hour. A lot of news this past week about network neutrality. It's not really a cybersecurity topic as much as it is just an internet topic, but certainly a lot of questions and controversy online about this. In the last year of the Obama administration, the Federal Communications Commission enacted what was called network neutrality. It's framed as a way to keep internet service providers from discriminating against the type of websites you go to or content. But really what this is two different classes of big business interests using the FCC to enact regulations to improve their bottom line and their positions. On one hand, you've got Google, YouTube, Netflix, and the like, who want a large amount of bandwidth to internet service providers and don't want to pay extra for it. On the other hand, you will have the internet service providers who want them to pay extra because a lot of people are using their bandwidth. There needs to be a lot of speed. Obviously, everybody gets mad about buffering or their favorite TV shows on Netflix or YouTube or wherever you happen to be watching it. So it's being framed often in the popular media as, oh, your internet service provider is going to charge you $5 if you want a social media package or to tweet. So there's a lot of kind of ridiculous FUD out there. But really what this is about people who has to pay for charges on the backbone. So really just big businesses arguing about who has to pay the bill for services. So you'll see a lot about that, a lot of fighting going on at the Federal Communication Commission, but really it's just big businesses having an argument and all trying to portray that they're being for the consumer. Really, they're for their own bottom line. But, you know, I know a lot of people have questions about that. I don't fully view either policy, whether we have network neutrality or not, being overly material about our internet experience, because we haven't had network neutrality until 2016 anyway, and certainly the internet has worked just fine without it. But a lot of sound and fury, but really big business is fighting over who has to pick up the tab for their dinner. So if you have any questions about that, of course, feel free to write in. Happy to talk more about that. Again, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek, on this Thanksgiving weekend. We're going to talk a little bit more later on in the hour about a lot of the holiday scams and attempts to steal your digital identity that we see during the holiday season. Often there's a lot of email campaigns and advertisements and the like that will try to get you to direct money to them, saying, hey, may you get one 60-inch HDTV, you get another one free, things of that sort, or various gift card scams and the like. Always be sure of who you're dealing business with. Make sure that when you are making purchases online, you're actually going to Amazon or Best Buy or whatever you intend to do, because there's a lot of low-rent trickery that goes on. I know I've talked in previous shows about using typos and slight errors in the web address of online shopping sites. So if you're looking, you know, to make purchases, it's usually best to simply just type in whatever website you're looking to go online. not clicking against on things in email, because that can be a little bit deceptive. So as you get things online, like I said, always be sure you're going to where you intend to. Be careful where you enter your credit card information. Like I said, we'll hear in the next segment why you should always use your credit card instead of a debit card for online shopping as well. So a lot of things to be wary of this holiday season. And in the coming shows, as we see things happening on the internet and scams going on out there, we'll be sure to cover those as well. So stay tuned for that. As we go through this holiday season, and I know certainly Cyber Monday, the so-called big online shopping day, is here coming up in a couple of days. So we'll be seeing a lot more of that here in the coming days and weeks. The last story I wanted to talk about involved car hacking. I don't believe it's a subject that we've talked about in great detail on the show yet, but like many other types of technologies that have existed for decades, there's a growing tendency and trend to make cars more internet accessible, more connected to the internet, to have things like, instead of listening to FM radio, to listen to Pandora, or to link to your cell phone, to have wireless internet inside the car, over the cellular network, a variety of things of that sort that are making cars more internet accessible or have access to various things on the internet. That results in some security implications that, you know, have not really been possible before. There is a great story out there from Charlie Miller and Andy Greenberg, who's a reporter. Charlie Miller, you know, got Andy Greenberg into a Jeep Cherokee and found some flaws in how it interacted with a cellular network that allowed him to take remote control over of the vehicle. So there's a video out there showing how scary this can be. It was done a couple years ago. But since then, manufacturers have taken this seriously and looked at some of the flaws to start addressing them proactively. And certainly there's big concerns as we get into more self-driving cars as well. So there's an article in The Sun out of the UK saying, you know, terrorists could theoretically, you know, have remote access and hack millions of cars or hundreds of thousands of cars, leading to a large loss of life. Certainly, it's a little bit of sensationalistic reporting. You know, they could shut off the brakes of a bunch of cars simultaneously, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean a lot of people are going to die. Certainly, a lot of mayhem will be caused. But really, the key is a lot of technologies we don't think about are increasingly being given network access. In the case of cars, a lot of those risks are well known. Automobile manufacturers are really taking a lot of good steps at this. Congress and legislative bodies around the world are certainly looking at regulations to force this. But there's a lot of risk in devices that you don't think about that have internet access. A lot of the CIA and NSA hacking tools that were leaked online and some reporting that you saw about that many months ago involved hacking of smart televisions, right? Many of you probably have a smart TV in your home, which basically means you can access Netflix directly from it, or YouTube, or whatever service you do. Well, those computers have operating systems. Those operating systems are connected to the internet, and there may be flaws in that operating system. Always make sure of all these devices you have, what has internet connectivity? What listens on the internet? You can usually tell that fairly easy because you have to set up some wireless network on it. You take it out of the box, you plug it in, and says, hey, what's the wireless network in your home, and give me the password. These devices can be compromised in a wide variety of ways, and that may involve some risks that people aren't thinking of. I think I mentioned this particular anecdote. I had a student last semester doing research into smart light bulbs. You know, where you're from your smartphone, you could sit there and have the white light turn red and do all sorts of things, dim it, whatever. Found that were vulnerabilities in this that allowed anybody to access it and could make the light flicker, right, at the right frequency that could cause an epileptic seizure, right? No one had really thought about that risk. The same thing for internet-connected toasters and refrigerators and the like. Figure out which of these devices you have in your home that has internet access and how you can update them. That is the single biggest thing you can do to make sure that all of these internet-connected devices that may be in your home or things that you may get for your children these holidays are secure. Is make sure that you can get updates, because, you know, we discover flaws all the time. Updates are how those flaws get fixed. So we're going to take a short, quick break here with that. Stay tuned for more. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek.
This is Cybersecurity Today with John Bambanek. This is Cybersecurity Today with John Bambanek.
And welcome back. You've tuned into Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek. Joining me now is Jerry Thompson, Senior Vice President of Identity Guard, the largest independent identity and privacy services provider in North America. I know I've gotten a lot of questions about the various identity services. Do they matter? And how to protect your identity, especially now as we're kind of going into the holiday season. We've had Black Friday yesterday, so it's kind of prime time for online shopping. So a lot of people are thinking about protecting their online identity. So thank you for joining us today, Jerry.
You're very welcome, and happy holidays to you and your listeners.
All right, thank you. So let's kind of jump right into it. I mean, first and foremost, right, Black Friday was yesterday. Cyber Monday is Monday. A lot of people are going to be starting shopping online. What are some ways that people can protect their online digital identity from various, holiday shopping scams?
Well, I think the two most important things that people can do, John, are A, do business with retailers that you are familiar with. Many times, especially when you're buying online, which more and more people do, including me, you can see an amazing offer from a company you've never heard of for a product that's in high demand. And then you can click on it and try to place an order when, in fact, you're placing an order with a cyber criminal that just wanted all of your information, including your card numbers. Mm-hmm. So be careful about who you're doing business with. It's always safe to do business with, Amazon and all of the big ones and many, many local merchants, but you should have a general awareness of who you're doing business with. And then the second one, which is equally important, is at this time of year, it's always best to use a credit card for your online transactions and not a debit card. A debit card is a direct line to your bank account. And while the banks have great security, it is a direct line to your bank account versus a credit card where, it's sort of disintermediated between the card issuer, the bank, and the merchant. And if, in fact, there's foul play, it never really affects the consumer. So I would say the two things, know who you're doing business with, and even if you've budgeted to pay cash for your purchases, mm-hmm. if you're purchasing online, use a credit card, not a debit card.
No, and I think that's a great point. I know, I travel all over the place. My credit card has been popped, and I think a debit card once actually was at a grocery store. And just calling the credit card company, it's a fraudulent transaction. I wasn't in this part of the world. The money goes back or the charge gets reversed. A debit card, the money comes back eventually, but, the transaction posts immediately. Money is, in fact, changed hands with credit cards is a period of time before money actually starts moving.
That's correct.
So, that's definitely a good tip out there for the holiday seasons. Another big breach happened this past week with Uber. Tens of millions of Americans affected. Some, I think all of the drivers had their driver's license numbers affected by that breach. Equifax has happened recently. With all these big breaches out there, there's nothing consumers really can do to prevent it, right? In the case of Equifax, they had my data. I couldn't tell them not to have my data. How do we protect ourselves in those kind of circumstances?
Well, John, I think the first thing everybody has to be aware of is don't get used to this and say, oh, who cares? Because not all breaches are the same. The Equifax breach was particularly dangerous because the type of data stolen, Social Security numbers, addresses, date of birth, gender, mm-hmm. driver's license numbers, phone numbers. The kind of data that was stolen is the exact data that cyber criminals use to create synthetic identities, which is the very, very brutal part of identity theft. So they can actually create another you and in another part of this country and put you in a lot of debt and walk away scot-free. So Most data breaches, even Uber to some extent, I know there were some addresses, but doesn't have social security number and date of birth, which are the two principal foundational points of your identity, along with your social security number. So people have to take care, and, you know, this is not a commercial for Identity Guard, my company, but we provide a service that not only monitors your personal information and that of your families through the credit bureaus, but through all of the banks and financial institutions, social networks, professional sites, dark web, public record. There's so much data about all of us today that is freely roaming the internet. Somebody actually has to monitor and look at it and let you know if, in fact, there's risk involved. And that's what we do, and I think consumers should, you know, all consumers should use the tools that are available to help protect their families and themselves, and we provide a really important one of those tools.
No, and certainly, like, there's a lot of data out there. You make a great point that's out there online. I know I use tools that I have professionally, right, to just see who's talking about me and my research, because I do a lot of research into cybercrime. So every now and then I personally become a topic of conversation. Being able to be aware of that is helpful, but there's a lot of dumps and password dumps out there online. Some of it gets posted openly on the internet, some of it in the dark web, and knowing when, you know, your account information, when your account information for something like your kid's soccer team was compromised, because we have a lot of these accounts we register for. They all have databases and usernames and passwords, and the same password we use for hundreds of different things, and it could be just the schedule for your kid's football team. Right. You know, if using some smartphone app that's compromised, and now somebody has the raw pieces to get into into your digital identity. So give some examples, right, you know, of how some of these, you know, small things, right? Yeah, we were talking off the air about kids' sports teams and some of the information collected there and how that can have real impact to somebody's identity and lead to large dollar fraud against consumers.
You know, here's the thing, and John, I'm sure you've heard this. I hear it all the time. Somebody will ask me what I do. I say I'm in the security and privacy business, and they'll say, well, you know, I don't need your service because I'm off the grid. I don't bank online. And I say, do you ever go to a hospital? Have you ever been to a doctor, a dentist, an eye doctor? Do your kids go to school? Do you have a job? Because your information, have you ever lived in an apartment, ever bought a car, ever got a cell phone? Our information is in thousands of places. So there is nobody that's off the grid or protected, and it's as base and analog as, you know, you filling out the sports form for your kids to play in a soccer league that asks you for your personal information and them for their personal information. Our information resides everywhere. The internet has provided us an amazing new paradigm of freedom, but it comes with risk. And, you know, the risk is that the information is out there and it's not as protected as it should be. Let's say the banks are the first, you know, the highest tier of protection. You know, your soccer coach who spreads your forms out on his table and then files them in a drawer or throws them in the garbage with all of that information is not the same. And we have to take care and caution to look for, to actively look for where we're exposed, because if we know you're exposed, we can actually help close that door.
Coming to the end of our segment, thank you, Jerry Thompson, for joining us, Senior Vice President of Identity Guard, the largest independent identity and privacy services provider in North America. You can check them out at identityguard.com. So thank you again for joining us, Jerry.
You're welcome, John. Thank you. Bye.
Take a short break here. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bannon.
Scan your computer, but don't scan the dial. Stay right here. John Bambadick will be right back. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today with John Bambadick.
Welcome back. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambadick, joining you here on this Thanksgiving weekend. A lot of great information there from our previous guest, Jerry Thompson, Identity Guard, identityguard.com. So a lot of things you can think about there about how to protect your identity. See if you've been the victim of identity throughout fraud and some of the other services they offer. So do check that out, identityguard.com. Wanted to switch gears to a little bit to a threat that you really can't address with these identity services, and that's going back to ransomware. I'm sure many of you know what this is, have heard about ransomware in the previous weeks and months. There's a very big problem that we have not yet been able to resolve, where the general case is you click on a link in an email or usually open an attachment, and the ransomware infects, encrypts all the files on your disk and makes a demand now usually around $1,000 if you're a consumer or a small business to recover your data. So it's a very big threat out there. Some research by a cybersecurity company called Bitdefender from Romania that I actually, interestingly enough, do some business with, says that right now ransomware is a $2 billion a year business in terms of just raw dollars going to the criminals. When you talk about the damages caused, it's over $5 billion. With WannaCry and some of the big ransomware attacks, I know we've talked on the show, hundreds of millions of dollars of damage were caused. But certainly this is affecting a lot of individuals, a lot of consumers, small to medium-sized businesses, hospitals, transit authorities. Earlier this week, the Regional Transit Authority of California had a form of this, though an attacker was just deleting data and trying to hold them hostage. So it's a very big problem that I did want to talk a little bit about to protect yourself. Because ultimately, right, if you're a small business, a home business, just a consumer, ultimately that protection comes down to you and what you put in place. So certainly getting a good antivirus helps. Bitdefender is an example of a good program that has some tools to prevent ransomware, even if they don't have a strict signature for it, because ransomware always behaves in a certain pattern. If you have a tool that can detect that, it can prevent the bulk encryption of a disk and a hard drive that to pay the ransoms. If you do get ransom, one of the key data points out of their report that I saw was only 47 people who pay the criminal get their data back. Early on, 2013, 2014, 2015, that number was much, much higher. The people who were writing ransomware were very sophisticated, very intelligent people, wanted to make sure people are getting paid. Now you got a lot of commodity criminals getting in. They don't really care if you get your data back. They just want to get their payday. They're not really thinking long term. So there's a lot of ineffective ransomware out there that's still good at destroying your data, but you're not necessarily going to get your files back. So not only you lose your data, you lose a lot of money as well. So one of the things always to keep in mind if you're a victim of ransomware is going to nomoreransom.org. They have a lot of resources, in some cases decryption tools, that may help you recover your files. You may want to hold those files at some point if you don't recover them, because often we find encryption keys and tools after the fact, so maybe weeks and months later you'll be able to recover your files. So certainly take a look at that resource, see if they have any data that can help you recover your files, because certainly there's a lot of interest in me and my fellow professionals to deal with this problem and really stop the flow of money into the criminals. The last thing to really keep in mind is ultimately ransomware gets on computers in the overwhelming majority of cases because a victim did something. They opened an attachment, they went to a compromised website, what have you. Always keep your machines up to date. Patch, patch, patch. Because almost all web-based compromised websites will install malware on your computer only if you have insecure older versions of your operating system or Java or Flash. So always make sure those things are up to date, because it becomes much harder for the criminal to get malware on your machine. The other main mechanism is email, usually in the form of file attachments. So just today, looking at some of the spam email I get, there's a lot of fake invoices out there. Here, open this invoice, or I want to send donation to your charity. Ironically enough, I actually do run a charity called the Tumaini Foundation, but it's not sent to that email. It's sent to other ones. So you open this, it's like a zip file, and it might be a PowerShell script or something called .wsh or a jar file .jir. None of those are document files. Those are never really normally sent in email. So if somebody's actually trying to send you something, right, it's probably going to be a PDF or something. But look at those file extensions, right? If you see .jar, definitely don't click on it. But usually if people are going to send you a PDF of an invoice, it's just a PDF. It's not something that's zipped up in a .zip file. But be very, very wary of attachments. Be very wary of email that's kind of coming out of the blue. I mean, if you're expecting something important or sensitive, then definitely verify that that was actually the email you were expecting. Because criminals know that some measure of people will click on it. Even with a 1 or 2% success rate, if they're emailing 100 million people and they get a click-through rate of 1%, that's 1 million people that have just become victims or potential victims. That's a large number, and emailing hundreds of millions of people is really not all that difficult. So always be wary of those attachments, especially when you're talking about zip files that have a bunch of other files, things that end in .wsh or .jar, anything that you wouldn't recognize as a normal file attachment. So if you don't click on that stuff, you then can't become a victim. If you do open a document file or whatever and it says, hey, we need you to enable macros and do this and do that, if it's an email coming out of the blue, you probably don't want to do that. There are some built-in tools for Microsoft Windows and other email readers to let you know that something doesn't look right, to give you that one last chance to say, hey, you know what? This doesn't look above board. I'm not going to continue through the chain of events to compromise yourself. So like I said, I've said it before, I will say it again, I know I've said it a bunch of times, a lot of cybercrime is based on tricking you to compromise yourself. So being a little bit smarter, savvier, looking at some of the content at stopthinkconnect.org, right, that three-letter phrase, stop, think, connect. Take a moment before you do anything to make sure that this doesn't happen to you, because you're the only one who can really protect yourself against this kind of threat. To segue into, in our last couple of minutes in this segment, talking about mobile malware, there's been a resurgence of Android-based mobile malware called BankBot. BankBot is essentially, it's a mobile application that's designed to get into bank account and financial information, usually masquerading as a free application of something else. So you go to the Google Play Store, you look for a free flashlight application so you could turn on the light on your phone to go look for whatever in the dark, and it could be the software. It's certainly not free flashlight software, but a lot of free software is fine. It's above board, but it's easy to put in software that masquerades and pretends to be something else that comes with a little something extra on top of it. The way to protect you, always install apps through the Google Play Store. This story, of course, broken by Cyberscoop.com, our digital partner. This involved malware that was loaded onto the Google Play Store, but Google eventually figures that out and removes it. They have a lot of defenses built in. Some third-party Play Stores are installing applications through text messages and the like. You don't have the benefit of any of that stuff. The second is when you install a new application that's otherwise unknown, take a look at the permissions that it wants. Often when you install applications, it says, oh, okay, these are the application's permissions that it wants. Oh, it wants to listen to a microphone and see out the webcam and read my text messages and look at my emails and see my browsing history. Most mobile malware wants what I call the Christmas tree of permissions, where there's hundreds of permissions that you can give an application. We're going to take a short break, bring on Greg Otto from Cyberscoop.com, our digital partner. So stay tuned. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek, and we'll be right back.
John Bambanek, on the radio and on the lookout for the latest cyber threats. This is Cybersecurity Today with John Bambanek.
And welcome back. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek, on this Thanksgiving weekend. Joining us now is Greg Otto from our digital partner, Cyberscoop.com. Welcome back to the show, Greg.
Good to be here, John.
So this week, big news out of Uber that I saw you guys have been covering, that Uber had a major breach, got data on 57 million users, usernames, emails, assuming ride history. But more concerningly for drivers, if you were a driver of Uber, it got your driver's license number. And what was novel about this story is Uber covered it up and paid the hackers $100,000 to delete the data. So tell us, tell us about this story. What's going on here with Uber?
Right. So Uber did, in fact, pay the hackers $100,000 to stay quiet after hackers found that there was some info on an Uber-owned GitHub account that eventually led them to credentials of an Uber account on an Amazon Web Services instance. And when they approached Uber, Uber was like, hey, we're going to cut you a check and please be quiet about it. That was under the tutelage of when former Uber CEO Travis Kalanick was in charge. Mm-hmm. But since then, there's been new CEO, and it has come to light that this breach occurred. And because this breach has occurred, a couple high-level security executives have been given the axe.
Yeah, no, I saw that. And I guess what's interesting about that, there's usually not public disclosure that a payment was made to delete the data. But it also seems a kind of a pretty big compromise that should have been reported to the public, whether or not they paid people to be quiet, correct?
Right. Right. And right after this story went live, the New York AG said that they were going to start to investigate. We talked to the California AG's office. The California AG is the most important one since mm-hmm. Uber is based in San Francisco. They would be privy to California's data breach notification laws.
Right.
I saw earlier on Tuesday that Massachusetts was possibly looking into this as well. So there is a very interesting conversation going on in the InfoSec community right now as to whether Uber really did a good thing by sort of covering this up by cutting a check and not seeing that information anywhere out there on the dark web or the public web or anything like that. So they cut their check, they got their data back, and they didn't notify any of the authorities, but there was still some negligence there. So mm-hmm. there's this really interesting argument going on right now about whether the payment was actually a good thing or a bad thing. I think that it goes beyond negligence. I mean, we have a regulatory system set up for a reason. And there needs to be some oversight of this stuff. I mean, it just reminds me of what happened with prior to the housing crisis, where there was such a move to deregulate the way that things were traded. And then you get into subprime mortgages, and then you get into the mess that we saw with the economic downturn in 2008. While I don't think that there's going to be an economic downturn because Uber did this, I still think that, you know, the model applies with that. Look, we have regulations for a reason, and whether you're a startup, whether you're a bigger company like Equifax, you need to follow this stuff because this data is becoming more and more important to everyday people's mm-hmm. lives, and you can't mess with people's lives in that manner.
Well, and I think I was talking to an accountant about industry regulations and some of the problems in this regard, right? If you talk about denial of service attacks where, hey, Uber's website is down for 2 hours and nobody can get rides, they are all over that, right? They've got every incentive because they can measure it in lost revenue. But when you talk of, oh, we lost email addresses and other things, Uber themselves is not going to face the harm from that loss of data. It's going to be the persons whose data that they lost, the usernames and email addresses and ride histories of individuals to an extent. But the drivers, where a driver's license number is basically as good as a social security number for a lot of things, they're the ones who are going to have to deal with identity fraud, which is why we have breach notification laws. Whether you paid them to delete the data or not is kind of immaterial for that legal requirement. So I think pretty much every attorney general and the FEC, is going to go after them from this, and I've heard from a lot of them that they plan to. But yeah, you make the point of, you know, was it great that they spent $100,000? Well, to an extent, it's better than what most companies did in Equifax, you know, assuming the data was deleted, and that is an assumption. You know, Equifax just kind of was like, it happened. Oh, well, at least Uber did something to try to make it right, though in this case, they should have disclosed it when it happened, which is why all those executives got canned, is they've earned Uber some legal liability.
And I wouldn't be surprised if, on top of Equifax and now this incident, if we start to hear some chatter about a national data breach notification law, because, look, like we were saying, Uber's based in California, mm-hmm. but it's everywhere. So you don't know how many people are affected, where they are in locations. And with the way that data breach notification laws are set up right now, in that it's kind of a mishmash across 48 states, mm-hmm. it's going to get to a point where you're going to have some standards on how to handle this stuff from a legal perspective. So I wouldn't be surprised if you start to hear some chatter about a national data breach notification law soon.
No, we hear it every now and then. And I mean, it's a matter of interstate commerce at the end. I mean, the data usually leaves the country. Uber does business everywhere. And somebody who's been on the business end of actually trying to consult and get organizations to comply with it, complying with 44 at that time anyway, different legal regimes had complication, because at a certain point you can't say, okay, this is Massachusetts data, so we're going to do these five things. Oh, this is California data, so we're going to do these seven. There's a lot of complexity there to just create one system to handle all that data instead of 51 systems, well, 53 if you include Guam and Puerto Rico and D.C., to comply with all mm-hmm. these laws. So, I mean, to an extent, yeah, probably Congress has a role here. And certainly, I know they're thinking about this, some new rules of the road post-Equifax breach, are they not?
I mean, I would have to think so, because, I mean, I talked to Jerry Connolly after Equifax, and he was like, look, we generally want to leave it to these companies to figure it out on their own. But if they're going to be grossly negligent, then, of course, we are going to step in. I think in the Uber case, again, we're past borderline negligence. Like, there were some things here that were just wildly wrong and mm-hmm. wildly inconceivable to anybody with any sort of knowledge in, you know, how these things work. So, it's just going to get to a point where it's going to take a national focus in order for this stuff to stop happening.
No, and I think you make a great point here. And I think, yeah, the key problem is when companies lose data like this, it's our data. We face the fraud risk. They don't. So they have no financial incentive. And I'm a big critic of GDPR, which is Europe's new data privacy legislation that's taking effect next year. But the one thing that it does do, right, if you're not protecting consumer data appropriately, you can be fined up to 4% of your annual revenue. And that was, in effect, an economic bomb going off that's getting all these institutions in Europe to really think about how they need to be protecting data, because they don't face the risk. It's you and I and our information that's lost, and we're the ones facing the risk. So it's a crude tool, but it gets businesses moving.
Yeah, and GDPR, I've talked to a lot of people that are really, really, really worried about how that is going to affect the way that they carry out their security operations. And, you know, the more and more breaches that we see like this, the more and more the worry is going to grow out from the security operation and really hit the boardroom. So I know there are a lot of people, I don't want to say panicking, but, you know, they're worried about how this is going to change things, and matters like Uber don't help.
No, it doesn't. I know a lot of people stood up and took notice that the CEO of Equifax got pushed out the door. In this case, a chief security officer got pushed. So certainly, you know, there's people in these roles who are taking notice. And, you know, we're still kind of making the same stupid mistakes of putting access credentials and source code repositories, where if you look at every best practices guide everywhere, you know, that is the kind of thing that should not be. But it's the risk of automation, right? If you're having automated jobs do things and push code out and all that kind of stuff, it has to have access credentials to put the pieces where they belong. And I don't think we as professionals have solved the best way to solve that problem. Want to thank you again for joining us. That's Greg Otto from cyberscoop.com. They got a lot of great stories up there, so go check it out. Thank you for joining us this weekend, Greg.
Absolutely. Thank you.
With that, it brings us to the end of our hour today. Hope you got a lot of great information on there from CyberScoop, from Identity Guard, some things to protect you from this holiday season for some of the threats that you're going to face. Hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend. You've been listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bamanek. Enjoy your weekend.